loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the news of the day. First, the Trump administration said today that it would allow states to impose work requirements on people in the Medicaid program. Next, President Trump waived part of the fines for five banks charged with fraudulent conduct, including Deutsche Bank, where he has at least $130 million of debt. Then the issue of war and peace is the issue of the day in Colombia. Will the ceasefire and peace process continue, or is it being derailed? And then WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange tweeted yesterday that he has been given an Ecuadorian passport, leading to speculation that he may leave that country's embassy in London. Finally, a myriad of human rights groups demonstrated in front of the White House every day this week to protest the government's failure to close the military and intelligence prison at Guantanamo. That's all starting now on Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to the fight for Medicaid. The Trump administration said today that it would allow states to impose work requirements on people in the Medicaid program. This is a major change in the healthcare program for poor Americans. We're joined from Bennington, Vermont by Mary Garish, an organizer and member chair of the Rights and Democracy Healthcare Justice Team. Mary, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for giving us this opportunity to get out the word about the terrible things that this administration is trying to do to people, particularly the most vulnerable in our population.
Can you explain to our listeners exactly what the Trump administration's idea is behind these new guidelines? Is it to push people off of Medicaid just to get them out of the program?
Yes, of course it is. It's to, well, I think it's actually more insidious than that. I think there are really two aspects of it. One is they want to push people off of Medicaid. And so what they want is they want to give states who didn't adopt Medicaid expansions or who already don't like spending money on Medicaid the option of telling people, you can't be on Medicaid because you're not working. But I think the really more sinister motive is to further create the stigma of being poor for people who are having employment and health problems, and to further divide our country so that instead of looking at each other as human beings who all have a right to health care, we look at each other as deadbeats and people who aren't working, and why should we all pay for them? And I think that's the myth and that their austerity budget tries to foster.
Mary is right. That's what's going on here. This is a rich man's government. I mean, the Trump administration reeks of, well, so did the Obama administration for that part, but
Without
least the Obama
doubt.
Administration through the Affordable Care Act did have, should have been single payer, but short of that, there was a vast expansion of Medicaid. So a lot of people, a lot of poor people, and when we say poor people, most of them are actually employed poor
working
people.
Poor,
but
yes.
even if they're not, they're human beings. And like all human beings, they get sick. We all get sick. We need to go to a doctor. We also need to avoid being sick by being able to go to a doctor before we're terribly ill.
Exactly.
And so the Obama administration expanded access to health care for some part of the population that didn't have it. And the Republicans and the opponents say communism.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Because God forbid you should help children who need health care.
Terrible. Go ahead, Mary.
And the thing is that what really kills me about this is what the reasons that they used to justify a work requirement for Medicaid were things like, well, statistics show that when people have more money, their life expectancy is longer and their health is better. Well, gee, maybe that's because they can get all the health care they need without worrying about whether it will impinge on their ability to feed their families. I mean, and then the other part was people are less depressed when they have more money. Well, yes. And people are less depressed. People that are on Medicaid are frequently depressed. I would imagine so. If I'm struggling because I'm ill and I can't afford my medications and I have a family to feed or even just myself to feed, and I have to choose between medicine and food, yes, that would be depressing. There's no doubt about it. So each one of these reasons, and I can't, I mean, there are, I think, five of them that are of similar ilk that they used. And each one of those reasons is just, I can't even, it's stupidity. And what it indicates is that the people that are the proponents of these good reasons, shall we say, obviously don't have a clue of what it means to be to not be able to buy your medicine or go to the doctor when you're not feeling well because you don't have the copay.
I can tell you what it's like because when I was arrested and lost my job and my wife lost her job, within days we realized, and I mean literally within days, we realized that we didn't have enough money for food, let alone healthcare. And it was Medicaid that saved us. I have five children. I wanted to work. I was desperate to work. And if I didn't have Medicaid to rely on for that brief period when we were utterly, completely broke, I don't know what I would have done. As Mary rightly points out, you have to make a choice between food and medication. And, you know, so many Americans need medication, whether it's for diabetes or high blood pressure or depression or whatever.
How can the country keep calling itself the richest country in the world?
Exactly.
And deprive millions of poor people the right to go to a doctor, the ability to go to a doctor.
And let's look at the people on Medicaid. Again, as Mary rightly points out, the vast majority are working. We're talking about the working poor. We're not talking about Ronald Reagan's welfare queen who never existed in the first place.
Right,
we're talking about people who either are working or want to be working. And the government now is just making it that much harder for them.
Mary, go ahead. And I just want to remind the audience that the people doing this, mostly men, mostly rich men, and to the extent that there are women, rich women, because most of the people in Congress are millionaires or about to be millionaires as soon as they leave office.
Sure.
And they're prioritizing taking health care away from poor people and saying, well, you may show us that you have the capacity or the right to go to a doctor if you can prove to us that you're going to start working, even though the fact of the matter is, in a lot of parts of America, there are no jobs.
That's correct. And, you know, and they think it's actually funny. I've been down to D.C. a lot in the protests. Prior to the, you know, when they were trying to overturn the ACA. And so a number of us got arrested a number of times. And one of the times we were standing there cuffed in front of the Senate building. And we were still saying, healthcare is a human right. This is why we fight, fight, fight. And Rubio walked by and we said, you know, people are going to die. And he laughed at us. He stood there and laughed and said, nobody's going to die. And even the Capitol Police, who had us in custody, their mouths fell open. But this is really, he thought it was funny that we thought people were going to die. How out of touch.
Yeah. Let them eat cake.
Totally clueless.
Let them eat cake.
Exactly. That's exactly what it was. It was just crazy. And that is the whole mentality. And this whole idea of, and the other interesting thing is the whole idea of getting rid of Medicaid and making people, a lot of the people that are supporting the Trump administration are the working poor on Medicaid. And I don't understand how they can support this. And I also don't understand how you can literally let people die. When we were protesting, there was a young man named Samson that was down there, and he uses a wheelchair, and his medication is very expensive. And without medication, he will die, and without Medicaid, he will not get his medication. Now, even I, who have MS, my medication is $1,500 a month.
Sure.
I live on Social Security. I can't pay $1,500 a month.
This is a debt. What you're saying is that this is actually a death sentence. People are going to be sentenced to death for the crime of being poor.
That's correct. If they're poor, let them die anyway.
Mary, with 30 seconds left, obviously we have to do something. What are you doing? What can people do?
All right. What we're doing is we are trying to make sure that even the Republican legislators in D.C., because in Vermont, our legislators are very empathetic to this. Our legislators have to know that they work for us. we don't work for them, and that their careers are toast if they don't start sticking up for the people who elect them to office.
I agree. It's time to light a fire.
Agreed.
Right under them.
That's right.
John, I think we're out of time.
Yep, that was the voice of Mary Garish. Mary is an organizer and member chair of the Rights and Democracy Healthcare Justice System. She joined us from Bennington, Vermont. Please stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We are going to come right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
President Trump waived parts of the fines for five banks charged with fraudulent conduct, including Deutsche Bank, where he has at least $130 million of debt. The waivers were declared during the Christmas holiday week, traditionally a week to hide bad news, and when the public is not paying attention. The networks just got a hold of the information today. We're joined from California by Jack Rasmus, a professor of economics at St. Mary's College and Santa Clara University, and the author of Central Bankers at the Ends of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy and the Coming Depression. Jack, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Jack, this just screams of conflict of interest. Am I missing something here?
It's probably worse than you think. It's more than conflict of interest here. You know, Trump just appointed two U.S. attorneys in Manhattan, a guy named Berman and Kazami, and these are former Deutsche Bank employees. So it's not surprising that they're going to make sure that Deutsche Bank doesn't have to pay fines and so forth. But I would go even beyond that. You know, Deutsche Bank is notorious for money laundering out of Russia. And it's probably tied in with the Trump pre-election contacts and deals with Russian oligarchs and money laundering and the Russian mafia and so forth. And I think that's really what FBI Mueller is going for, to see what these contacts are. And, of course, maybe Trump's tax deals going back. You know, Trump keeps saying it's, there's no collusion after the election. Well, I think the investigation will find their deep contacts.
There could be deep contacts because Trump has been trying to do business in Russia for a long time, and he didn't really succeed at getting business permits for a long time. He wanted to build, you know, a Trump hotel in Moscow. That didn't work out. He went to Deutsche Bank also because American banks sort of dropped Donald Trump because of all of the previous bankruptcies. But one thing it seems to me, Jack, is, and tell me if I'm wrong, that these five banks have also been granted waivers by the Obama administration, no?
Oh, yes. You know, it's pretty clear for some years now that the big banks, the Democrats have deep contacts with the big banks. Hillary had deep contacts with them. And of course, Goldman Sachs is running the show now in the economic policy in the Trump administration. All the major appointees are Goldman Sachs CEOs and presidents and so forth. And so is Bill Dudley of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. He's a Goldman Sachser. So, the contacts between the Democrats and Republicans and the big banks are both very deep. But Trump is another case here. I mean, Deutsche Bank is really notorious and the worst of the worst as far as money laundering and deals going and so forth. And of course, Trump is tied up with them. And just because Trump did not get any contracts, we don't know if that's true or not.
Right. But your assertion that there was a definite collusion between Trump. I mean, we're no fans of Trump, but we just don't see any evidence of actual collusion. I mean, we see that Flynn has been pled guilty to lying to the FBI about his discussions with the Russian ambassador related first to Israel and then in response to after Obama imposed sanctions and shut down Russian compounds. Michael Flynn had a discussion with the Russian ambassador to the United States whereby he said to them, and the NSA had this on record because they collect all the data, that, don't over-retaliate. Don't retaliate more than what's been done to you. But that's the kind of stuff that happens in all transitions. I mean, it doesn't actually prove any collusion, and it's after the election.
No, you misread me. I did not say the issue was collusion. That's why Trump is emphasizing no collusion. I think what they're going after is pre-election illegal deals, bribes, and so forth between the Trump organization and the Russian oligarchs and so forth. I think that's where they're going to find their violations of law. And I think that's where where Mueller's going. It's not collusion. Collusion's not the issue. It's bribes and shady deals and fraud and illegal deals before the election. And, of course, Deutsche Bank is the intermediary between Trump and the Russians for a lot of these deals. So it's not collusion. It's something pre-election.
Let me ask you, because you're focusing on your bank and banks, and I want to read your book from 2016. Why is it, Jack, that when U.S. banks engage in illegal activity like money laundering for drugs?
And like UBS famously did. Brad Birkenfeld blew the whistle on that.
Yeah. And Wachovia was found guilty of laundering, I think, $370 billion, some large number like that for drug money. They were bought out by Wells Fargo, and then Wells Fargo paid $160 million fine on $360 billion of drug laundering. I mean, you have Americans, I mean, millions of people are in American prisons. A lot of them are in prison because of drugs or drug crimes, low level. But here you have the big banks who are indispensable to the international drug trade because of money laundering, and they get found guilty and they pay fines. They don't go to jail. How come?
Well, none of the bankers have gone to jail since 2008, 2009. I mean, that's what's new about the 21st century. In the past, at least some token, like in the 1980s, some token bankers went to jail. And of course, before that, a lot of bankers went to jail after the Great Depression. But none of them go to jail anymore. That's because I believe the finance capitalists, who are more powerful than they've ever been before, have deeply penetrated the government. They are in the government. They are part of the government, and they no longer get purged, you see, because of their role. That's what's changed. The finance capitalists are running the government unlike any time before in U.S. history.
Yeah, when they have an attorney like Covington and Burling senior partner Lanny Brewer, who then becomes the assistant attorney general for the criminal division and makes a very public decision to not prosecute bankers. And then when he finishes, he goes back to Covington and Burling, where he represents the bankers. Then the entire system is corrupted.
John, this is democracy.
No, well, yeah, another good example of just that revolving doors is between the Federal Reserve Bank and the private banking sector. In my most recent book, Central Bankers at the End of the Ropes, I have chapters that talk about this deep connection and exchange of personnel between board governors and the banks themselves, and how the banks still control the 12 federal districts. The bankers really run the central bank. Once a guy like Ben Bernanke leaves, and Janet Yellen is leaving now, they reward them nicely. They go on these big speaking tours for $200,000 a speech to banking trade organizations and individual banks. They reward them very nicely. You see, it's not like Latin America where they corrupt them in office. They do their bidding, and once they're out of office, then they get nicely recompensed. And of course, that's true with government in general. You know, they all go on their speaking tours. I mean, Clinton did it, and Obama's doing it. They all do it that way.
Yeah, the Clintons made $143 million in speaking fees after Bill Clinton left office. Yep. And, you know, when you think back about it, John, Secretary of Treasury during the Bush era, that was Hank Paulson. Mm-hmm. He had been the chief executive officer of Goldman Sachs.
That's right.
Then Goldman Sachs ran the Obama administration. Now you have Gary Cohn.
You got Mnuchin in the Treasury, Goldman Sachs. You got Cohn at the Economic Council, Goldman Sachs. You got Bill Dudley in the New York Fed, Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs drafted this big, huge tax ripoff. six guys, you know, Mnuchin and Cohn and a couple of assistants. They're the ones who crafted this entire tax ripoff bill, where in an article I have forthcoming, the tax cuts for corporations are really well over $4 trillion, not 1.5, 4 trillion and maybe even 6 trillion.
And then when they torpedo the government, as happened in 2007, 2008, 30 million people lost their jobs. 9 million families were put into foreclosure. 3 million families actually lost their homes. And then the government says, well, in order to keep the system going, to retain buoyancy and solvency, we're going to draw a circle around the biggest banks. We're going to bail them out. $660 billion in direct cash to these banks. No questions asked, no strings attached. And then trillions of dollars in loan guarantees. And Jack Rasmus, we only have about 90 seconds left. When you look at who's left in the banking world, you see the same monopoly concentrations of power and wealth as we see in the media world. J.P. Morgan, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, Citigroup, Goldman Sachs. These are the people really running America. I mean, it's of, by, and for the banks at this point.
Well, you have to expand your list there. It's not just the commercial banks that you listed, except, of course, Goldman Sachs is an investment bank. It's what I call the shadow banking system, which now holds more investable assets than the commercial banks. By shadow banks, I mean the private equity groups, firms, the hedge funds, the boutique banks, the asset management companies, and so forth. This is even bigger than the commercial banks. And of course, they're connected at the hip, both the commercial and the shadow banks. But the shadow banks are even more unregulated and even more Wild West banking. And they're the guys who are really behind the right wing and the Breitbarts and the Bannons and so forth. This is the Wild West banking sector, and it's growing in power like never before. It's not just the commercial banks.
It's not getting any better, at least not in the near term. That was the voice of Jack Rasmus. He joined us from California. Jack is a professor of economics at St. Mary's College of California and at Santa Clara University. And he's also the author of Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy and the Coming Depression. Thanks for joining us. Please stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. The issue of war and peace is the issue of the day in Colombia. Will the ceasefire and peace process continue, or is it being derailed? We are joined from Bogota, Colombia, by Mario Murillo, professor of communication and Latin American studies at Hofstra University. He has covered Colombia for over 25 years. He is the author of Colombia and the United States, War, Unrest, and Destabilization. Welcome back, Mario.
It's great to be with you.
We've been talking about this issue of war and peace in Colombia for a long time. The ceasefire has technically lapsed. Can you give us an update on what's happening there?
Yeah, when we're talking about war and peace in Colombia, we're talking about a very complex, different and several levels of war and peace. So I'll try to break it down as quickly as possible. The ceasefire that you're referring to right now is the perhaps breaking story news of the last 24 hours or so here in Colombia. And that's the negotiations that are ongoing between the one remaining armed insurgent group, the National Liberation Army, known as the ELN, that have been negotiating with the government of Juan Manuel Santos now for about a year and a half or so, trying to resolve a peace process and come to a peace agreement that will end their conflict that has been going on for about 50 years. This comes in the wake of last year's peace agreement and accord that was signed between the government of Santos and the other rebel group, the larger group that is essentially now demobilized, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, the FARC. That's a whole other story, which we can talk about in a second. But the ELN issue is of concern because they were essentially following a 101-day ceasefire, a bilateral ceasefire between government forces and the ELN throughout the country, but in particular in the area where we saw most recently in Arauca and north of Santander in the northeastern part of the country where the ELN for decades have been very strong and have maintained considerable territorial and military control. If not control, at least they've had a large presence there. And breaking of the ceasefire, apparently the reports that we're seeing are up to seven different attacks, including one a soldier that was killed by an ELN a sharpshooter yesterday. That ceasefire, and then there was a few attacks on bridges and some in an oil pipeline that it was that's traditionally been their tactics of the ELN to destabilize that part of the country. Seven attacks over the last 24 hours, and it came literally hours after the ceasefire was supposed to expire. Right now, the government had hoped that it would continue and extend the ceasefire, because the next day it was literally right after today. Essentially, the fifth round of negotiations was supposed to resume in Quito in Ecuador, where the ELN negotiators and the government negotiators were supposed to continue their conversations. But as a result of what happened over the last few hours and these different attacks, Santos called back his main negotiator, Gustavo Bell, to Bogota for consultations. It's not an indication that there's a total breakdown of the negotiations, but it certainly creates problems for them to move forward given these most recent attacks.
Well, let's just talk about the ELN's motives, if you would. Are you're suggesting that the ELN is taking the military initiative here, or responding to military provocations? And if they're taking the initiative, what would their objective be?
Well, it's really hard to gauge. I've been trying to make sense of it. Certainly, it is a military initiative that the ELN are taking. I think their point was, and it's perhaps not a good political point, but not being on the ground there, it's hard to tell exactly what has gone on. And judging from the various news reports, you do try to make sense of the situation without coming to definitive conclusions. But what it most likely is the ELN is showing that there's a need to extend the ceasefire. But as long as there's a war going on, as long as the conflict continues and the ceasefire is suspended, belligerent operations are, part of the game, right? Now, politically, that doesn't look good, because essentially, the Colombian people are tired, and it's hard to say this, and it's hard to convey this to a North American audience. But for so many years now, they were negotiating with the FARC. That concluded with lots of difficulties, with lots of problems on all sides of the issue. And then now you have the situation with the ELN, where people are saying, okay, let's wrap this up, as well as a strong cross-section of the right in Colombia that wanted forget the negotiations and want to go all out and continue a military engagement with the ELN to try to beat them on the battlefield. So for them the ELN has argued, no, we want to continue negotiating. This is just part of the game. This is part of the situation. As long as we continue negotiating while there's a war going on, there's going to be these operations. There was no indication in the public pronouncements that the ELN put out, both in Ecuador from the negotiators as well as on the ground here in Colombia, as to what were the motives and what kind of triggered the attacks. So that's where the clarity and what actually specifically happened is hard to tell. But certainly, strategically, from a political standpoint, it might have been short-sighted on the part of the ELN to carry this out, again, without knowing what the circumstances were specifically on the ground. Now, the government insists that they're not breaking negotiations, but they're going to have consultations. Certainly right now, I'm sure they're having those consultations, and we'll probably hear about it in the forthcoming, next 24 hours or so.
Mario Murillo is our guest. We're speaking to him from Bogota, Colombia, where there is now fighting after the apparent lapse of the ceasefire between the ELN, one of the second largest armed rebel group after the FARC, which is, as he said, demobilized at this point. Mario, we were speaking and have been speaking to a number of, they're predominantly North American social justice and peace activists who have been in Colombia and have been part of the process or supporting the process of the peace negotiations over the past period. And what they're telling us, or what they told us last about a week ago, is that there's an alarming number of people who have been wounded or killed by right-wing paramilitaries. These are people who are not necessarily disarmed or demobilized FARC, but people from the social justice or civil society movements. I'm wondering how much of a factor that might be in terms of the ELN's calculations, if in fact it's a part of their calculations at all, and how big of a problem does it pose for a real peace?
Well, this is one of the major problems that is facing the entire country. Over the last five weeks that I've been here, I've gone to a number of different regions. I was up in the northern coastal area of the Sierra Nevada of Santa Marta, visiting and working with the indigenous communities there, the Canquamo community. I was in the areas of Montes de Maria, which suffered vast mass levels of violence over the course of the conflict, particularly by right-wing paramilitary groups over the decades of the war. I just came back from northern Cauca in southern Colombia, literally just last night. And in just about every region, and most of these regions have been really directly affected by conflict, they all point to the fact that while there's a certain level of tranquility now that the direct combats have ceased, both between FARC and government as well as ELN and government up until yesterday, despite that, there's still targeted attacks, targeted assassinations against indigenous leaders, against human rights activists, against workers struggling around land recuperation. People struggling around protection of environmental, spaces in the countryside, particularly confronting extractive industries that have been given sort of a green light now. In fact, this has been one of the criticisms of the peace process by progressive forces in Colombia, is that yes, maybe there's a need to end the war, but at the same time, does that give multinationals and domestic extractive industries a green light to go into these territories and do what they want to do? So as a result. As a result of that organizing and mobilizing that has occurred all over the country, we've seen literally since last year, since the peace agreement was signed, since it started moving forward into implementation phase, and depending on which report and statistics you look at least 104 human rights, and again, it's social justice activists, human rights leaders, including some former FARC combatants who demobilized. The number is about 104 across the country, and that might be a conservative estimate. And so what the argument is that, well, the state once again is saying, yes, we need to bring peace, but on the other hand, they're not providing the guarantees for communities that are most at risk. And especially since the FARC demobilized last July, I was in northern Antioquia, which is a very strong guerrilla stronghold for decades, a coca-growing region up there. And since they demobilized and disappeared from the area, we've seen the incursion of so-called neo-paramilitary groups in the area, putting pressure on communities and targeting specific individual leaders. And so the communities across the country are saying, you know, yes, we want peace, but we need it with guarantees from the state that we're not going to be kind of open season for armed groups that remain and continue to put pressure, both for territorial as well as economic control reasons. So yes, that is one of the major problems, and it'll probably continue to be a major problem as we move forward, both vis-a-vis the implementation of the accords with the FARC and any kind of peace agreement that might come forward with the ELN, if indeed that does happen.
Mario, I want to ask you to expound on that just a little bit. You mentioned a moment ago ongoing attacks against human rights workers, social movement activists, indigenous people, peasant leaders, etc. Do you attribute that to the end of the ceasefire, or is this an ongoing problem that we've seen all through the whole ceasefire process?
Well, I mean, this has been a problem for the past 50 years in Colombia. I mean, I've written a lot about it. A lot of people have written about attacks against social movement activists and trade unionists and journalists and independent journalists and activists across the country, political leaders from the left. There's always been an intolerance against the kind of progressive forces in Colombia. So this is not new. But yes, in the wake of the peace agreement, what we're seeing is targeted assassinations specifically. So it's on a smaller scale. We're not seeing the mass scale massacres where we would see 20, 30 people killed at a time, like we did during the heart of the war between the 2000s up until about 2008, 2009. But we are seeing people getting targeted, and it's directly connected to their organizing on the ground to try to build a better future for Colombia. Now, the Colombian government has deliberately distanced itself from that. They've actually made repeated arguments that those are not systematic attacks against social movement activists, that they're very isolated incidents, and in many cases, they have written it off as false claims, you know, describing some of these assassinations as, you know, love fights, crimes of passion and some other things like that. So the government has not taken responsibility, and that's one of the things that human rights activists and workers are particularly concerned about.
That's all the time we have. Our guest has been Mario Murillo, professor of communication and Latin American studies at Hofstra University. He's covered Colombia for over 25 years. He's the author of Colombia and the United States, War, Unrest, and Destabilization. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange tweeted yesterday that he has been given an Ecuadorian passport, leading to speculation that he may leave that country's embassy in London. But the British government said that he will likely be arrested as soon as he walks out. We're joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst Walter Smolarek. Walter, there was a lot of activity on this issue yesterday. Julian Assange's attorney specifically asked the British Home Office what they would do if Julian were to be given a diplomatic passport. The British told the attorney that they would ignore any request for diplomatic status and Julian would likely be arrested. So is there any way out of this for him?
No one can really be sure what's going to happen, but I think it's outrageous that the British government is holding him in what even the United Nations deems to be arbitrary detention. You know, he's somebody who's not running a quote unquote non-state for intelligence agency like the U.S. government and so many of its sycophants claims. He's running a news agency. WikiLeaks is engaged in legitimate journalistic activity. And the government of the United Kingdom, by refusing, you know, even all these very reasonable proposals that are being put forward by the government of Ecuador and by other international actors, I think, is a complete outrage, and it's an affront to the freedom of the press.
You know, what we're witnessing here, John, is an all-around bullying campaign. Julian Assange isn't facing criminal charges, nor was he facing criminal charges from Sweden.
That's right.
And now there's no charges whatsoever. And Julian Assange has been a media outlet that has been, in his organization, WikiLeaks, has been essential, I would say fundamental, to the expansion of democracy and the expansion of media coverage about issues that are pertinent, not just relevant, but foundational to global politics. We know so much about the Iraq War because of WikiLeaks. We know so much about how the U.S. was treating the government of Libya and the governments in the Middle East because of WikiLeaks. We know so much about the fact that we were being spied upon by the government that says it's defending us,
right,
because of WikiLeaks. Mm-hmm. And then you have all these media outlets, including The Guardian, including The Washington Post, The New York Times. They've been glad to use WikiLeaks materials that WikiLeaks, this media outlet, has provided. And, you know, the shocking thing to me is that all of these mainstream media outlets are glad to use his material, glad to use it for media and for profit, but they don't do a thing to stand up for Julian Assange, who I would say has been targeted unfairly by the biggest and most powerful governments in the world, not because he did something illegal, but because he talked about what they did that was illegal, like the war in Iraq. That's what's really going on here. And Ecuador, whatever the domestic politics are in Ecuador, and we know we have a new government, we don't know where this government is going to end up politically compared to the Correa government that gave Julian asylum. We don't know what's going on inside of Ecuador, but we know this. Ecuador, too, is a bullied country.
Sure it is.
Because all of the Latin American countries, if they were left to their own devices, if they were not pressured by the Americans or the British or both, they would take a policy track that would be completely different than one that might be imposed upon them. So what we see here are two sides, two global sort of sides in a collision course right now. Those who are fighting for justice and fighting for information and fighting for democracy and fighting for transparency on the one side, and those who are fighting for those things are fighting that for Julian Assange to be set free. And those who don't want that, they want to incarcerate Julian Assange to make an example out of him to tell other whistleblowers and truth tellers, don't you dare. You're going to end up in an embassy for the rest of your life. You're going to be subject to arbitrary detention, which is what the UN calls this. Or you're going to be hauled off to the United States where there's a secret grand jury right now.
That's right.
Investigating Julian Assange and WikiLeaks.
I've spoken to Julian through intermediaries, our attorneys. We actually share one attorney. And I've told him exactly the same thing. Don't leave the embassy if you don't have to, because you will be extradited to the United States and you will never receive a fair trial here. Never.
Yeah, we have politicians in the United States in the halls of Congress calling for him to be put to death.
Exactly. Exactly. Where's the justice there? You know, he would likely be indicted in the Eastern District of Virginia. And I have railed against the EDVA on this program and in writing in a column that I have. And I say the same thing to him. He'll never get a fair trial. They call the Eastern District of Virginia the espionage court for a reason. And that reason is that no national security defendant has ever won a case there. The deck is stacked. There is no justice, and he'll never get a fair trial.
And Walter Smolarek, again, Julian, this is from today. Julian Assange has been granted Ecuadorian citizenship, as that country's government says it is seeking a, quote, dignified and just, those are quote, dignified and just resolution to the WikiLeaks founder's extended residence in its London embassy. Ecuador wants a dignified and just resolution. That's what Julian Assange wants. I mean, but the fact of the matter is, unless the people who believe in democracy, believe in transparency, unless we do something, unless we sound the alarm, unless we go into the streets, unless we become active, unless we become players in this political struggle, it's going to be Julian Assange against the most powerful governments in the world.
Yeah, I think former President Rafael Correa made a very courageous decision to give, a safe haven to Julian Assange in the Ecuadorian embassy. But, you know, like you pointed out earlier, Ecuador is also a bullied country. The United States, the UK, you know, these superpowers are able to put a tremendous amount of pressure on lots and lots of governments all over the world. And so to correct that equation, to balance that out, the only possible thing that could balance that out is the advocacy and the activism and the organizing of ordinary people who know that what WikiLeaks does, the important, crucially important work that WikiLeaks does is ammunition for movements for social justice, for movements against U.S. war and intervention abroad, who are advocates for the rights of nations to self-determination and sovereignty to exist without the interference of these great powers.
John Kiriakou, talking about truth-telling, you went to prison for 2.5 years. You were a CIA officer. You went to prison not because you tortured, but because you whistleblew. You told the world, you went on the American mass media, you revealed that the torture program existed, even though George W. Bush, the most powerful person in the country, said it didn't. And then the government went after you, first Bush and then Obama. Under Obama, and since that period of time, there is a war against those who are telling the truth. And Julian Assange is just the latest victim in this long line of people who are the truth tellers.
He is. And you said something a few minutes ago that's very important that I wanted to highlight. And that is that Julian, like Ed Snowden, like Tom Drake, like John Kiriakou, are all used as examples to try to frighten everybody else into silence, right? Because that's the only way that our government can conduct this dirty business, is when there's silence. Now, when I was arrested and charged with 5 felonies, including 3 counts of espionage, Scott Shane at the New York Times published an article on the front page of that paper in which he said that as soon as I was arrested, all of his national security sources went silent. They all dried up. And that is exactly what the government wants to happen. That's why they're pursuing Julian Assange like they are, because they want everybody to stop talking and to stop reporting on evidence of waste, fraud, abuse, and illegality, which is the definition of whistleblowing.
And just think about what WikiLeaks is showing us, revealing to us, we the people. What is it showing us? It's showing us documents from the government. In other words, it's not making stuff up. It's not like sort of hyperbolic editorial material. These are government documents about what the government that says it speaks in our name and uses our tax money, what this government and other governments is doing. And because WikiLeaks has helped us understand what the government is doing, which we should be entitled to know, that's the essence of democracy. Because of that, John Kiriakou is right. They want to bring him down because others who, you know, are suckers for the truth will step forward and want to do the same thing.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note that the war on WikiLeaks began under President Obama, under a Democratic administration. John, you were targeted by both Republican and Democratic Indeed. Presidents. And, you know, the Obama administration was among the most aggressive in U.S. history in terms of targeting leakers, whistleblowers. And so, you know, so Trump, for instance, was at the top of the list of the Committee for the Protection of Journalists list of, like, threats to press freedom.
Yes.
And there's this sort of this mythology that, like, the threat of the government to press outlets began under Donald Trump. Donald Trump is a detestable human being. He certainly is a threat to the freedom of the press, but he's not like an aberration. You know, I think it's a continuation of a long line of administrations seeking to clamp down on the expression of any type of information or ideas that they find politically inconvenient.
Last thought on my part, John, and I'll give you the last word. WikiLeaks Iraq war logs revealed hundreds of thousands of pages of documents showing that the war in Iraq was an illegal criminal war, that there were crimes against humanity that were being committed by the Bush administration. That's what those WikiLeaks Iraq war logs showed. The people who made the illegal war happen, who authorized it, who enforced it, who justified it, who rationalized it, who funded it, those people are going around making speeches and getting a lot of money every week or every month. They're writing books. They're sort of rehabilitated as great statesmen in the United States. And the person who told the truth about their criminal conduct is holed up in an arbitrary detention in Ecuador and now facing possible life imprisonment if he were to be extradited to the United States. I mean, the unjustness of this situation can't be overstated.
I agree, Brian. I think Julian Assange should be celebrated. He should not be incarcerated or charged with crimes or extradited to the United States. Without Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, we would have no idea the depth of American crimes in Iraq. We would have no idea the crimes against humanity and the war crimes that took place. We would have no idea that NSA and the rest of our government was spying on American citizens. The man should be celebrated.
I agree. I agree completely. We've been joined in studio by Walter Smolarek, Sputnik News analyst. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
A myriad of human rights groups demonstrated in front of the White House every day this week to protest the government's failure to close the military and intelligence prison at Guantanamo. The prison still holds 41 people, six of whom are cleared for release. President Trump, however, has said that nobody will be released, and he wants to start sending even more prisoners there. We're joined in studio by Jeremy Varon. He's a professor at the New School in New York, and he is one of the organizers of this week's demonstration. Welcome to the studio.
Thanks for having me.
Before we went on the air, you were telling us about a lawsuit. Please tell our listeners about that as well.
Yeah, so today was a big day for us. As you mentioned, it's January 11th, and it was on that day in 2002 that the first so-called war on terror detainees were brought to U.S.-run facility in Cuba. And we've been holding demonstrations on January 11th for the last 10 years calling for the closure of the prison. We did that again today, and we can talk about that a little bit later. But earlier in the day, the Center for Constitutional Rights and other law collectives filed a lawsuit on behalf of 11 currently detained men that made a new series of legal arguments reflecting presumed change in policies brought by the Trump administration. So as you know, under Obama, there was a process for men cleared through an interagency review process to leave. So there was a principle that individual cases would be adjudicated on the particular basis of that individual's case. And then Trump has announced a blanket ban on anybody leaving Guantanamo. And he's also made inflammatory Islamophobic statements in connection to Guantanamo and a variety of other policy areas. So the argument of the lawsuit is that this is arbitrary detention as never before, based on the hateful whims of the president, and now you need the relief of the courts to provide some meaningful way for people to leave, given that the interagency review process has shriveled up. And in addition, they want to challenge, as never before, lower court rulings basically okaying indefinite detention under the auspices of the AUMF, which authorized post-9/11 war making. And then they want to argue that the hostilities in Afghanistan, substantially against al-Qaeda, against ISIS, have meaningfully ended, so that folks can't be held under the AUMF any longer. So it's a novel lawsuit that's gotten a good amount of play in the national press already this morning.
Let me ask you one specific question about some of these releases. You know, during the Obama administration, lots and lots of people were cleared for release from Guantanamo. There were often, quite frequently actually, delays in those releases because the U.S. government had difficulty finding other countries willing to take some of these people. So they ended up in places like Albania or Tahiti or Uruguay, odd places that probably would never pop into your head if you were thinking about where you're going to resettle a former Guantanamo prisoner. It's my understanding, though, that none have been released under Donald Trump, even though they've been cleared for release, just because Donald Trump doesn't want to release anybody. Is that true?
That is correct. There's currently five individuals who've been cleared for release, some as long ago as 2009, who are still being held at Guantanamo. So those are particularly hard luck cases. And then we heard this morning about an individual who was ordered released, but the U.S. didn't file the request within the 30-day window required by law, and he wasn't released essentially because of a delay in a clerical error in the late stages of the Obama administration. And then evidently his doctor had given him back medication to be able to handle the flight home from Guantanamo. So he was that close. And then, you know, the lawsuit represents two folks who are currently cleared, but really is pushing towards some final adjudication of the whole prison population and saying that we need to reckon with this as a country and not feel that we can pick at the problem to make it more manageable.
Yeah, I remember being at the CIA in 2002, and someone had this idea to use Guantanamo as a temporary way station, which is really all it was supposed to be, as al-Qaeda fighters were being captured either in Afghanistan or Pakistan. The idea was to send them to Guantanamo for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, just long enough to then figure out where in the United States you take them to face trial. So we're talking about nearly 800 people over the years. Of those nearly 800 people, one has been put in front of a military commission, or at least one has been convicted of a crime. No one else has ever seen a day in court. No one else has ever been charged with a crime or has been given his constitutional right to face his accusers in a court of law.
Right. And we heard today very moving testimony from your former colleague, Mark Fallon, who was the chief naval and counterterrorism investigator responsible for building the cases against, war on terror captives. And he described being at Guantanamo, eagerly awaiting the first plane load of the worst of the worst. And then his orders were, like you said, that Guantanamo is a temporary facility. They wanted swift justice, along the model of the Nuremberg trial.
Exactly.
And then they realized very quickly that they got the wrong guys, that a lot had been turned over for bounty. He essentially said it was a human trafficking operation.
That's exactly
right.
What it was.
So that's one problem. And then the other thing that you're also aware of is that there was always this tension between Guantanamo as a place to deliver rough justice in the war on terror versus a place for interrogations. And then very clearly, the side that prevailed at Guantanamo is that it's an interrogation facility that had a military intelligence objective and, properly speaking, had nothing to do, you know, with the law. And then, you know, that tension has always defined Guantanamo. And then if people think that it's a place for justice in any sense, they're sadly mistaken. And then one constituency that complains about Guantanamo is the former 9/11 families who haven't seen the putative killers of their loved ones like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed brought to justice, and has seen many, 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 many innocent people tortured in the name of the memory of their loved ones. So it's heartbreaking for them on two levels. And a member of that group, 9/11 Families for Peaceful Tomorrow, spoke today at our demonstration as well.
Many of these prisoners who are innocent or who may have been low-level foot soldiers for this, that, or the other organization, they're grabbed, they're kidnapped in essence. Their families might not know where they are. They just disappear into this black hole. And then there seems to be no end in sight, no light at the end of the tunnel, no justice, no attempt to, no ability to face your accuser. Eventually, and they're tortured. A lot of them are going through all sorts of techniques and sleep deprivation and sensory deprivation, things that are clearly torture. And so at a certain point, they went on hunger strikes because they didn't have a voice. I mean, you were a voice. The Witness Against Torture was a voice. There were relatively small organizations trying to sort of be the tribune to tell people what was going on in Guantanamo, but they didn't have a voice. So absent a voice, they went on a hunger strike or hunger strikes. And then instead of doing something about the conditions or expediting the process so that they could have justice, the U.S. government resorted to force feeding, which is another form of torture. Talk about what happened.
Right. And then we learned this morning that there are currently detained men on hunger strike, including one of the clients of CCR named in the lawsuit. So that's ongoing. There were hunger strikes starting shortly after the prison opened. And then the last really big one was in 2012, 2013. And then, yes, one way the government dealt with it was to force feed people, to keep them alive, to punish them for their dissent. It's a grueling, procedure. But one effect of that hunger strike was to get Obama to restate his goal of closing Guantanamo, to activate the periodic review boards, which could provide the reconsideration of the cases of detained men, and then to name out of state and Pentagon Gitmo envoys whose job was to try to release men. So, on the one hand, the hunger strikes, were met with harsh reprisals, but it also was the detainees using what little means they had to remind the world that they, still existed. And then in our community, we try to be their voice, as you said. But more importantly, we take direct inspiration from them who find ways to speak out under unimaginable circumstances.
President Obama said when he came into office that one of his top priorities was to close Guantanamo. He said, we tortured some folks, mm-hmm. which I thought was kind of trivializing it in terms of the word usage. But he wanted to close it. He did want to close it. The Republicans and his political opponents, for political purposes, I think mainly, wanted to stop it because they wanted to stop anything Obama did. If Obama said the sun rises in the east, they would have said, I don't know, you're a communist or something. But anyway, Jeremy, we have about a minute left. Why is Trump taking this position of just banning any release? Is it ideological? Is it political? Is it just cruel?
People at the press conference said, I think very rightly, that it's simply to make him look tough in the eyes of the base, that he wants to appear tough on terror and tough on Islamic extremism, etc. So we have a policy now based in his own idiosyncratic hatreds and whims that has nothing to do with a proper legal process and then isn't in the best strategic interests of the United States. So this truly is a new frightening level of the arbitrariness of these detentions. And then we can only hope that the court case has some success and that activists and advocates continue to speak out and good hosts like you continue to talk about it in the media.
Jeremy Varon, thanks for joining us here in the studio. Jeremy is a professor at the New School in New York and is one of the organizers of the demonstrations at the White House that we've been talking about. That is unfortunately all the time we have. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We're out of here.
Loud and clear. We'll be right back.